If Mr. Gallup, Mr. Roper, were to poll Americans on the city where they would prefer to situate themselves, I doubt that Cleveland would get many votes. Clevelanders accepted, of course. Next time that you visit out of town, try a word association test with your hosts. Mention New York, and they will answer you the Statue of Liberty, the Empire State Building, Wall Street. Mention Washington. You'll hear of the Capitol and the White House and Washington's Monument. Mention Chicago, and you will hear of the stockyards, Michigan Avenue, Pittsburgh, Steel, and the Golden Triangle, and then Cleveland. And I'm afraid you'll be met by a sheepish silence. Cleveland is in many ways the best kept secret in America. 1.5 million people situated someplace between Pittsburgh and Chicago, in something called the best location in the nation. But just where is it? Cleveland is in population the 8th largest metropolis in the United States. In terms of industrial output, we rank 7th. At one time, we outproduced 34 of the states of the Union. We produced more goods than any one of those 34 states. But you will search the history books of America vainly to find the history of Cleveland written and inscribed. We have produced the sinews of power, but we have not been a seat of power. We have manufactured products, but not headlines. You'll have to turn to the statistical appendices to find Cleveland, the number of tons of pig iron bolted down, the number of tons of shipping brought in and transshipped, the volume of goods produced. This is Cleveland. Its history, balance sheets. Its history, plant expansions. Its history, almost entirely economic. And perhaps it is right that it should be so. For Cleveland is an economic child, the child of the Industrial Revolution, born of a marriage of convenience between Mesabi ore and Appalachian coal, the marriage celebration danced by the light of the burning furnace fire. Cleveland began as an industrial park for the great cities of the East, the older cities, the larger cities. Here, conveniently, coal and lime and iron could be brought and manufactured, and the dust of the furnaces would not despoil the air, and the price of the goods would not rise so high as to be prohibitive. And it was a good marriage, a marriage which was fruitful and multiplied. Cleveland is a rather new city. Though surveyed in 1796, Cleveland, by the Civil War, was still less than 50,000 in population. But from the end of the Civil War till around 1930, our city grew at a rate faster than any other city in the United States, numbering 46,000. At the end of the war, we numbered 930,000 in 1930. The economic roots were good, and they were sound, and they were healthy. Cleveland produced and reproduced itself again. But being a child of the Industrial Revolution, Cleveland, like so much else of this revolution, was awkward and ungainly. We are not an architecturally distinguished city. We have few quaint streets and broad thoroughfares and magnificent parks. Oh, we have a public square, and we can say about it that it is public and square. Beyond that, we have no unique architectural characteristic. High first-rate art and first-rate academic came late to Cleveland. After all, it is not so long ago that our magnificent museum devoted the largest part of its floor space to stuffed horses and medieval armor, things of interest to the sons of ironmongers and smiths, but certainly not the finest product of human handiwork and artisanry. Our universities have never played the role in Cleveland that a Harvard has in Boston or a Columbia in New York City. Cleveland was born out of economic necessity. Cleveland has remained largely a business community. Cleveland has supported culturally largely that which the business community found necessary immediately for its own interests. According to grammatic convention, cities are she's. We might describe Washington as being a vigorous suffragette, determinedly ungracious and uncharming. New York is a smartly dressed, well-turned-out, but cold-eyed sophisticate. We might say that Los Angeles is an exuberant bobby soxer, arms and legs akimbo, going in all directions. But I'm afraid that when we came to describe Cleveland, we could say no more than that she is a middle-aged, house-coated mother, warm and tender, but not at all chic, and possessed of far more common sense than cultivation. But you know, mothers wear well. And Cleveland, though it lacks the glamour of many another center, has a heart and a warmth and an expansive tenderness which destroys much of the cruelty and the coldness which is inevitably characteristic of urban living. We may rate very low in terms of architecture, natural beauty, sophistication, but Cleveland has a high rating of decency. Cleveland has never had a major outbreak of labor violence. Cleveland has never had a major moment of racial tension and unrest. Cleveland has invested itself from the very beginning in the business of education, and its city schools have been among the leaders, the pioneers in the nation, and we have never compromised there with quality. Cleveland pioneered in many aspects of voluntary social welfare, and our united appeal was and remains one of the most effective and successful fundraising charitable organizations in the United States. Cleveland has a warm heart. Indeed, one might say that the human being in Cleveland tends to be a little more human, and to live a little more humanely. When we are pressed to the wall, for we don't very often brag about Cleveland, when we are pressed to the wall to describe our city, we tend to say, it's a good place in which to live. It's a good place in which to raise children. It's not exciting. It's not adventurous. It's not cosmopolitan, but it's a good place. And it is. 52% of us live in our own homes, the largest percentage of home owning in the country. More of us live in standard and adequate housing than in any other major city. Our wealth has been rather broadly divided and distributed throughout the population. And Cleveland is a city of surprising wealth. We were founded on economic roots. These roots bore rich, colorful fruit, and this fruit has been enjoyed by a surprising percentage of the population of our city. Cleveland has faced in its history many crises. The crises of labor, the crises of nationality, the crisis of race. As a city of only 50,000 at the end of the Civil War, we had to import the workers, the sinews, the muscle for our plants. And from that year till the end of the First World War, Men from every nationality across the face of the globe poured into our city. Greek, Italian, Irish and German, Pole and Ukrainian, Slovak and Czech, Hungarian and Romanian, these all came to our city. And be it said to the everlasting credit of our city that they were not turned over to the ruthless exploitation of the robber barons. We had our robber barons, but the constabulary in Cleveland was never turned over to the Union Club. We had in Cleveland always a group of civic-minded leaders, men of the law, men of the teaching, men of the cloth, citizens all, who spoke up. And unionism came to Cleveland early and without bloodshed. We had no Haymarket Square riots. It came to Cleveland intelligently, with intelligent leadership on all sides. Cleveland can be proud of that record, proud that it pioneered in unemployment insurance, in methods of arbitration and compromise of labor disputes in the union shop. Cleveland can be proud that some of its industrialists went against the current of their own group and of their own established conditions in their plants higher than those existing elsewhere in the industry. And Cleveland can be especially proud of the way in which it treated the foreignness of the foreigner. The general pattern was to bleach out this foreignness, to insist on Americanization. Cleveland did not. Cleveland established nationality centers. Cleveland insisted on proud unity and proud diversity, that each man retain his cultural heritage. And a symbol of this, we have not only the foreign language newspaper, the nationality centers, but the cultural gardens in our parks. And a symbol of the success of this, we have an unpredictable political situation, and this itself is in urban politics unique. People cannot predict how Clevelanders will vote because the roots and the family tree of a candidate do not tell exactly how many votes he will garner. Machines have rarely been successful at the upper level of Cleveland politics because Clevelanders have voted for men. Nationality blocks have not been used cynically. And as evidence of this, as evidence of the uniqueness of this fact, I give to you a history, rather a study of Cleveland completed just 6 months ago by two men trained in the cauldron of New York politics. And among their other punditing, they prophesied that Cleveland would have Catholic mayors for this foreseeable future. And of course, both party candidates in the last election were Protestant, and the Democratic Party candidate in the primary was also a Protestant. Cleveland has consistently fooled the IBM machines, because Cleveland has voted for men and not for points of national origin. The mother has been good to us. The mother has been kind. The mother has created a situation in which we could grow up in strength, has given us schools and parks and recreational facilities and an economic climate and opportunity, given us youth and manhood. But I wonder if we, the children, have been grateful in measure to the bounty which has been ours. The cycle of life in Cleveland is centrifugal. The thrust of our life is outward, away. We have slammed the door on the home, picked up our baggage, walked out without looking back. We hardly even bother to pay the weekly visit so that the grandchildren can be petted and fondled. We have moved ourselves, bag and baggage, out of the city. Today, as many of us live outside of the city lines as within. Now, this suburban movement, this mass exodus, has been typical of every major city. But in Cleveland, we have taken it to the nth degree. In Cleveland, we lacked a large apartment area which might anchor significant numbers of the professional class and the business class to the community. In Cleveland, we lacked a White Way, a successful merchandising institutions, academic institutions which had broad communal support, which would attract as magnets, bring down, return those who lived without to the city. As a result, in Cleveland, it is not at all impossible, and indeed it is quite prevalent, for many to be of our city and to never enter the city, to be of Cleveland, but not in Cleveland. Indeed, there is a wall in Cleveland, quite as high, quite as impenetrable as the wall which separates Berlin. We are today two cities. One, the 103 governmental areas outside, the small suburban groupings, the other, the large center within. The one, well-fed, well-housed, well-educated, the other suffering a crisis in welfare. The one boasting the richest suburban metropolis in America, the other suffering with 1 in 20 of its citizens on the unemployment rolls. The one glutted, the other impoverished. The one refining, building swimming pools, the other lacking the funds with which to give 80% minimal support to the families which are in relief. And the wall is high. And though it is not visible, it is real. It is psychological. It is emotional. I remember sitting behind a lady at a dinner one night who said to her companion that she would like to go to the art museum, but she was afraid to go there. There is fear of entering the city, and fear of those who live in the city that if they happen to wander through the suburbs, they may be picked up and asked by the police to leave. We are not one city, but two. And we are two cities which must struggle to understand each the other. For I'd remind you that the word civilization is etymologically derived from city. It is the city which has always given the urge, the vigor, the challenge, which has permitted civilization. Suburban means less than urban. In suburbia, the doctor visits your home. In the city, you have the research hospital and the training school. In suburbia, you build libraries for your students, which will provide you with the bestsellers. In the city, you have the library, which provides all volumes, a research tool. In the city, you have, in the suburbs, you have roads. In the city, you have rail and airplane transportation and shipping. In the suburbs, you have leisure. In the city, you have sport. In the suburbs, you have secondary education. In the city, you have the graduate university. Only in the city can the clash of ideas, the clash of men, the arena of politics produce great civilization. The city is the challenge. And ultimately, the city is our economic future. For it is the city which must attract industry. It is the city which must bring new plans to our community. It is the city which must sponsor the overall regional planning without which this area becomes chaos. And yet what happens in our community, in these two cities which are ours? A year ago, I was at a meeting of the United Appeal of its Division A. Secretary Celebrezze, then running for mayor of our city, was the speaker. He wanted to make the point that he was there not as a politician running for office, but out of a lifelong deep dedication and concern with the values of the United Appeal. And he began by saying that, after all, no one could fault him cynically for appearing here during election time. There wasn't a vote, after all, in the whole room. And it was true. Here, a cross-section of the business leadership of the community, and not a one of them could vote in the election which determined the mayor of the community. Our business leadership makes its economic decisions quite apart from the polity which will ultimately be affected by these decisions. And those who lead that polity struggle to find avenues of communication, means of consulting, means of coordinating. Because suburbia has meant in Cleveland not only green lawns and a little bit of fresh air, it has meant a turning of the back, a determined turning away from the city and its problems. We want none of these. Delinquency, it belongs in the center city. Crime, it is of the center city. Welfare, it belongs to the center city. You pay the bill, center city. And paradoxically, the center city, the poor, cannot pay the bill. Cleveland today, our Cleveland, the one Cleveland, must rededicate itself to its own unity. Clevelanders today must stipulate that they are willing, all of us, that all of us are willing to give of our tax dollar for the relief and the welfare of all of our citizens. Our responsibilities do not stop at the boundary lines of Shaker Heights or Cleveland Heights or Pepper Pike. They are countywide. And if we cannot, for various reasons, establish some form of urgently needed metropolitan government, then at least let us find the ways of adjusting institution after institution so that we have one library system and not many, one county hospital and not private hospitals and one only for the city, one regional planning commission and not one for each area, one series of zoning ordinances and not a thousand. Cleveland, the Cleveland, the one city, the city which will permit the civilizing of our people. This city, our city, requires us. We must be citizens. We must be part of. We must give of ourselves to. We must communicate with. We must tear down the wall of fear, the wall of economics, the wall of simply lines drawn arbitrarily on a map, the gerrymandered political wall, which separates us from them, which separates us from ourselves. Because ultimately, what happens in the city happens to us. If the city fails in its welfare program, overspill of delinquency, of crime, of truancy will come into our suburbs. It will affect our nation. It will raise our taxes. Ultimately, if the city fails in education of the illiteracy of the South, we will pay the price. Ultimately, if Cleveland cannot have a climate which will attract new business, we will not be able to pay the bills which keep us in the suburb, for we live off that which this city produces. We are one, Cleveland and suburb. We are one, and we must remain one. Amen.